The following is an at-will presentation.
Welcome to The Marrow, conversations with creatives about who they are and why they make what they make. I'm your host, Josh Reebok. This week, I'm speaking with photographer Richard Douglas. Richard Douglas, photographer. You live in Phoenix, Arizona.
I do.
And I mean, this is our first episode of The Marrow that has not been recorded in New York City. And so I'm in Phoenix now. I think my flight is in, I should probably look at my watch.
You should probably look at your watch.
I think my flight's in 4 or 5 hours, but it is such an honor to have you on the show. From the beginning, when myself and some of the At Will Entertainment people were talking about individuals we wanted to have, on the show, you are absolutely one of the people that I wanted to have, not only because I'm such a fan of your work as a photographer, but I'm just a fan of your mind. I'm a fan of your heart. I love you to death. Hmm. And so, dude, thanks. Thank you so much for having me do this. We're actually sitting in Richie's, I guess this is the dining room.
This is, yeah, it's like the dining room / living room.
Yeah, in a house that was built, what?
1916. It's like a Spanish style house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really remarkable. There's like a stained glass window on the front door looking out, and a lot of windows, cathedral ceilings.
Yeah.
It's amazing to be here. But I want to start with this, Rich. Tell me what life was like growing up. I mean, describe for me the childhood of Richard Douglas.
Well, my childhood was crazy. So I was born here, born and raised here, and there's not a lot of us that were born and raised and still remain in Arizona. For some reason, people get the bug and they leave, they go other places. I don't know. I don't get it. I guess I get it. I'm just denying reality. Didn't we just get done talking about that? I was born to a woman who was a drug dealer for a motorcycle gang here. My father was in that motorcycle gang. When I was two, my mom kind of forced him away because she wanted to quit, doing meth and rolling with that gang. And so she kicked my dad out and dad left. And I was basically raised really poor. And it's crazy too, because it's just like my mom did drugs for so long. I think it was like close to 2 decades that she was doing like meth and heroin and like all this
leading up to your childhood.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like before I was born. And when someone like quits like a drug like that, or like drugs like she was taking, they don't just become normal. You know what I mean? Like they don't just become a regular person. Like there's trauma, like my mom, she saw so much stuff. And she's been through a lot during that time. And when she came off drugs, she kept the emotional instability. Like she kept, she was like, she's bipolar. She has, multiple personality disorder. She depression. Like it's crazy. My childhood and growing up was really, it was just really crazy.
Yeah.
Everyone was always yelling and screaming, and there was like physical abuse and emotional abuse and, all that stuff. And, for a long time, my dad came back into our life at 16. He was told that he had hepatitis C. And
now, had you had much of a relationship with him between his departure when you were 2 and his return when you were 16?
Yes and no. He would come around. I mean, here's one instance I remember. Like, there was one day where my mom was like, she somehow like got a hold of him and was like, hey, the kids are like really hungry. Like we need money. We were living off of like welfare. And my dad came over high and like handed my mom $5 and then drove away. And I just watched her face. Like just, I still remember her face, like her facial structure. And like when she saw how much my dad was trying to hand to her, I've never seen someone deteriorate that quickly. What I mean? Because it was, that letdown was like multidimensional. I think what was most like, a big letdown of that instance was the fact that her 2 kids were watching that.
Yeah, right.
We were standing right there. And so, yes, my dad was there, but, not as much or in the capacity in which he should have been there. But he got diagnosed when I was 16, and the doctor told him like, dude, like, listen, man, like you're going to have to stop using drugs if we're going to treat you for this. And so he did. And then they treated him. They got rid of it. But, you know, obviously he was in fourth stage cirrhosis. And so, you know, it wasn't until like, I think, I mean, actually, he just got done having his birthday, which is crazy. But yeah, it's been 3 years since he's passed away. And it's crazy. It's just like, I'm just glad I got to like spend, like get to know him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because a lot of my friends who did, who grew up without fathers didn't ever meet their fathers. You know what I mean?
It sounds like you feel like, I mean, I don't know at what point, but it sounds like, I mean, even the way you talk about him, there's like a hint that, of fondness there, and that you had some like good years together before he passed away.
Well, you know, like going through all that, I don't want to sound like blindly optimistic or like, believe me, I'm a realist. Like I don't go around like trying to find the good in everything. Like, like, you know, I'm a realist. Like at least I would consider myself as such. And like, I just know that we all do things in a way that, I don't know, like we all just, everyone has their own thing, man, you know? And it's just like, he was born and raised in such a way and was taught things and, you know, that ended up in him doing what he did. You know what I mean? But the reason I experienced fondness in him was like making an effort, you know what I mean? When confronted, I guess. I don't know. I don't know why I was fond of him. I don't know why I am fond of him. Like, honestly, he was an asshole.
Yeah.
Like he left us, but I don't know. Maybe I'm blatantly optimistic. I don't know.
You can be a lot worse things, but I remember even like with my dad, like there's part of me that, you know, and by no means were our childhoods the same, but there's part of me that wants to cling, depending upon the day, some days I want to cling to the good memories of him because I want to feel a sense of connection to him. I want to feel a sense of fondness for him. And then other days, you know, I don't even know necessarily the reasons why, but it's like I choose to or want to cling to the more painful things because maybe on that particular day, it's just easier to hate him.
Yeah.
And so on particular days, I kind of cling to the memory associated with the emotion that I kind of want to feel in that given day, in that given moment.
I mean, like if I were to be honest, I can't think of any good things he's ever done though. Like that's the thing is like, I somehow justify the way he treated my mom and my brother and I, like I kind of like justified it on the basis of, oh, he's really a good guy deep down in his heart. And it's just like, but like, you know, I was abandoned so many times. Like there were so many times where he was like, hey, I'm going to pick you up for your birthday and never showed up or like, you know, just left us for, you know, nothing. And it's just like, and when I think about it too, like if I'm just being real, he didn't come back into our lives until he was diagnosed with hepatitis C. It wasn't even us that like brought him back. It was the fear of death. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe circling back. Maybe that's why I am fond with him. Cause that is something that I have shared, with him was like that fear of death. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's still something I'm like figuring out every day.
Well, so when in the midst of all this, Rich, did you first start to like become aware of or first start to kind of put your hands to your artistic impulses and ambitions? I mean, do you remember the first time? I mean, your photography is really spectacular, but you're artistic in a whole number of ways. I mean, do you remember like the first thing that you did or really worked towards in the kind of artistic arena?
I mean, like when I was a kid.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah.
I remember painting this like drawing out with markers this giant mural of like a space shuttle. I think I was in like third grade or something like that. It was like I was so young, and I just remember like doing this like really, and like to me it was like a big piece at the time. Like
sure,
you know, it was this big sheet of like white craft paper or whatever. And like I drew this giant space shuttle and I was just trying to be as detailed as I could about Jupiter because it was flying past Jupiter. and then I made this book like traveling through the stars, or like it was like shuttling through the stars, something like that. And I took like two sheets of cardboard and like covered them with like Christmas wrapping paper that was stars, and then like on the inside I drew like, I just basically wrote out this book. of like me traveling the stars.
And so there was hold on, just so I make sure I'm tracking. So there was like the big space shuttle flying past Jupiter, kind of mural portrait, and then there was a companion piece.
There's a companion piece. There's a book. I wasn't done. There's a book. Yeah, and so that was like that was the very first time that I remember being creative. And it was awesome bringing that home because my mom, like, literally, like, I don't know where the photo is, but she has this photo of me with that, like, laying on the couch, and that piece was, like, hung up behind the couch.
Really?
Like, she hung it up. Like, it was this giant, like, yeah, I was like, oh, cool, that's mom. Amazing. Like, mom digs it. So, yeah, that was, it's always nice seeing your stuff on walls.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember one of the first things. I want to, this is at least the first thing I remember writing, is I wrote a comic called Marvelous Marvin. And if ever you've read Calvin and Hobbes, I mean, it was complete plagiarism of Spaceman Spiff and Calvin and Hobbes. I mean, he looked the exact same. I think maybe his suit was colored a little different. But I remember making these comic books on like 3x5 index cards, and I'd write out the panels and draw it all in. And then my companion piece, Rich, was I actually sewed together a Marvelous Marvin doll. And so I got like
creepy.
Yeah. I got like a bag of like beans at the grocery store and like put it in the fabric and like sewed them all together.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because I didn't think of it until you said it. But my mom kept that doll on like her on like the vanity, like right in front of the vanity above her dresser.
Tight.
And I like it's amazing like how much that meant to me.
Yeah.
Because it was, I don't know, I think for me is there's something pretty remarkable when you make something and it means something to you, but then you kind of intersect with the moment where even if it's your mom, where you realize it means something to someone else. I mean, that's like a, I don't know. For me, there's like an echo, not only that I feel satisfied in what I made, but almost like there's like a feeling of solidarity.
Yeah.
Like people, I like things that other people also like I'm not alone.
Yeah.
Like that's like a really like special
moment.
I mean,
you're trying to extend yourself. You know, like my work is literally like me trying to process my trauma and process how I view reality, you know?
Do you remember the first photograph you ever took? Not. Yeah. I mean, like,
I do. Yeah.
Do you? Okay.
I really do, and it's funny because it was of a trash can.
Really? Yeah. Like what? Like it where was, on that timeline of your life is this?
It was the very first time I ever. So like how? Oh, this is funny. So how I my first camera was, I got my first like student loan check from college.
Okay.
And with that check, I bought a camera. Like it was like a shitty like Nikon D80. Like it was a really, really shitty camera.
Okay.
And I don't know why, but the first photograph I ever took was of a trash can.
Hmm.
I saw something in it, and it was weird. Like I don't know, But
you make this sound as if it was more like impromptu. Like I'm like the way I'm picturing this. If this were like a scene in a film, is that you know. Richard Douglas is walking past something and then you just saw it and you stopped and you set your bag down and broke your camera out, as opposed to you kind of like staging this whole thing and like planning it out over 2 weeks.
Yeah. Nothing was staged. It was exactly like that. I can't remember what event I was like on my way to. Actually, I think I was like taking my camera because there was someone else that I knew that had a Nikon and I was just wanting to borrow some lenses. Okay. But like on my way, I was just walking by this trash can and I just photographed it. It was weird. It's like it looked really cool, but like its purpose was to hold like shit no one wants. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was. I feel like that was like the first moment I like knew that I wanted to like kind of pursue it too, which is like that I wanted to pursue taking photographs because it's just like when I see things there, I see dimensions to things that, you know, that aren't really visible, that people really aren't interested in looking at, but you know, I am. I don't know.
But that's a fascinating question. I mean, that's something I want. I'd love to hear you talk about. Like, what are you? I mean, looking for and your photography. You don't just have human subjects or landscape subjects. Like, you have such a wide array of subjects that you approach. But like, what is it you're looking for in your work when you approach you know, the time to take the lens.
Yeah, I look for a number of things. Like the main thing is oddity. Like one of the things I love the most is taking mundane objects or things and like photographing them in a way that like adds emotion to them.
Like a trash can.
Literally, yeah. Or, you know, trees. Like I remember I there's this like I have this series called Stranger, and it's the photographs that I took in Michigan. Like once a year, my in-laws, we all like my wife and my in-laws, we all go to Michigan and like have like a family reunion of sorts. And I just remember like while being there, I felt like such like an outcast and I wanted to take my camera around. And at the time I was like walking around with like this, I looked like such a weirdo walking around because I have this camera that I used for that series. It was an old Hasselblad, a 1978, you know, Hasselblad camera. And you look down through like you hold it at your waist and you look down at it. And I had these like straps around my neck and I was just like, you know, walking around with this camera and like getting weird looks from people and you know, all this stuff. But I wanted to try to photograph things in a way that like when if someone else were to look at the photographs, they'd be like, man, this looks like a really eerie place, you know, like this looks like such a, they can sense the uncomfortableness in it. So it's like, I don't know, like I feel like whatever I'm looking for, I'm looking to help people view it the way I do in that moment in which I took the photograph. Like I'm wanting people to resonate with me or vibe with me, I guess, like when they see, you know, whether it's a person or an object or a location, you know.
How would you define beauty, Rich? Like, I mean, when you, I guess
that's a crazy question.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess like maybe part of what I'm asking is it seems like we go through eras where there's like a template for beauty, where it's like beauty is, you know, if you're talking about like in the modeling world, it's like this is what is beautiful or attractive, and it's these dimensions and it's these measurements or this look, or even from like an architectural aesthetic standpoint, it's like now this is beautiful or this. I mean, so how do you define beauty, especially given that oftentimes there's a template kind of impressed upon us?
I feel like what's beautiful to me is what's real. Like reality is the most beautiful thing to me. Like literally, I don't think there needs to be, and this may sound weird, but it's like, I don't, with all that is out there that is real, I don't really see a need for imagining things that aren't, you know what I mean? And I think what like got me to like thinking that way was like watching my grandma die and then watching my dad die. Like those were two instances where I saw something in front of me that was really raw and really real. And the way it drew emotions out of me and still does to this day, you know, to me, that's beautiful. Like it's incredibly painful.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's beautiful.
Well, and I think of even some of like, the iconic photographs that have been put before me. I'm blanking. There was a recent one about the boy, the little boy. I want to say it was from like Aleppo, and he's like being placed in the back of the emergency vehicle, and it's so sad. And it's for me, like I seeing that, like you feel the sense of heartbreak, but then I also felt the sense of like anger, of like this isn't right that this would happen. But to your point, then there's also this kind of like peculiar form of beauty even in the midst of that, because it's demonstrating a genuine human being.
Genuine, yeah. I guess that, dude, honestly, like I was raised in such an environment where everything, I was told to believe a lot of like what I believe now to be fake things. Like there was a lot of just pseudo-ness to like to my entire existence. Like everything was fake. And like when I was able to like go out and explore and like think of things in my own way, it wasn't until like I experienced, you know, experience that freedom, you know.
You mentioned earlier when you were in Michigan kind of feeling a bit like an outsider, kind of,
of
stranger in a strange land kind of vibe. Do you think great art tends to come from people who feel like outsiders?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to say yes to that. To think about the world in a way that like violently affirms reality, that is that makes you look kind of crazy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like when you're talking with people, or when you're like just now, like labeling my dad's death as beautiful, or like my grandmother's death as beautiful, like. Some people are like, what the hell? Like, did you, like, that's disgusting. You know, like, right, that's weird.
Morbid.
Right? Morbid, yeah. Right? Yeah. It's just like all these, then just throw the labels on me and go for it. But it's just like, yeah, it's just like, you know, yeah, it's very lonely. And like, not a lot of people get that. Like, not a lot of people can see that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's something about a voice that is sometimes alienated, that's able to, I mean, I get the old aphorism when it comes to writing is the magic of writing is being able to take something foreign and make it feel familiar, or vice versa, taking something familiar and allowing it to feel foreign. And I don't know if I would say that I think that's, or I would say I don't think that's universally true. I do think it's often true, though. Is it takes someone who is a little bit outside of maybe kind of the current cultural template. I'm blanking on who said this, but I heard someone say that great artists tend to either be ahead of their time or before it.
Oh my God, yeah.
So it's kind of like an artist is always a bit of an anachronism in their own time, where they don't totally belong then, but it's that very thing that allows them to kind of awaken other people to certain realities that they want to put before the public.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah, dude, it's, yeah.
What inspires you, Rich?
Man.
I mean, like, give me the full range, like just in like the mundane, like don't get too existential or profound. Like, I mean, what makes you want to make things?
I don't know. I can't help it.
Man, that makes me mad, because I need to like gorge at the banquet of inspiration.
Yeah,
like, well, I need to watch a great Daniel Day-Lewis performance. Yeah. It's like I need to like this summer, Kristen and I, we went and saw Guns N' Roses in concert, and it was like almost.
Are they still alive?
Oh, come on, dude.
I don't know.
Like, it was almost the original incarnation of the band. So it's like Axl and Slash. But I need, like, being there was so inspiring, just to see these kind of like rock anarchists doing their thing. And Slash came out to this like kind of peninsula on the stage in 80,000 people, MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. The whole stadium is blacked out. One spotlight on his leather-clad body, tall top hat, aviator shades, long cigarette like Cruella De Vil, and on a two-neck guitar, he plays the theme to The Godfather. And like,
that's like all of your things.
Oh my gosh.
Like, that's like all
of
the things.
Yeah, I just like, I was like, I need my laptop.
Yeah.
Like, I need it. But I need to like consume in order to kind of create. So it makes me mad that you're just kind of there.
Yeah, dude. Like, honestly, like when I first started creating like art, I would do that. I would go out and seek inspiration and like draw like themes from other people's works that I would, you know, see or view or like. But I just found that my work was not, it wasn't reflecting my voice. It wasn't reflecting what I needed to say. And so, yeah. And so like now at this point, it's all about like, just make shit, right?
Yeah.
Just work, like get to work. You don't have to go around like creating the most deep, like create, like for you, it's a little like, I mean, I don't know. I don't mean to speak for you, but for you, it's like a writer. Like you want to be writing profound things, right? But like, you know, with photography, sometimes the vernacular is beautiful, like sometimes just mundane real life things.
Yeah,
you know, dude, oh my God, there's this awesome Tumblr, and it's called Craigslist Mirrors, and this guy, this photographer, literally like went on Craigslist, mm-hmm. like in a bunch of like a bunch of different cities, mm-hmm. and he took people's photographs that they have of mirrors, mm. like just random mirrors, right?
Yeah.
And then he curated all these photographs and created this like thing you can look at for hours of all these photos of mirrors, and you see like. You see humanity in that. Like, there's this one photo that I saw that was so odd and but lovely. It was this this older, like heavier gentleman that was taking a photo of his mirror to sell on Craigslist, but he didn't think to get out of the shot. So it's literally just a photo of him. Like, I think he had his shirt off. Like, it was so crazy. Like, and he was just like holding up the camera, and it had a flash. So it like flashed, and like so you just see this like. You know, shiny area. And like, I'm like, damn, that's sick. Like, this guy literally took the most mundane vernacular thing and made something really, really interesting to look at. Something that gives you an eye in, you know, into how these people think when they're trying to get rid of mirrors.
To me, you raised such a, there's like a really fascinating conversation in there of how as an artist do you retain you and not just become kind of a part of the homogenized mass of voices in the process. I mean, it's like I've seen the thing where someone says, do you even remember who you were before the world told you who you're supposed to be?
Right. Yeah.
And I think that's so like challenging as I mean, and not even just as a maker of things, but just as a person. It's like, how do we not kind of just become our surroundings, and how do we kind of retain any sense of who we are
it's like hard.
In the midst of that,
dude, it's so hard because being homogenous with your work and like blending in with like the culture it tends to make you money, you know what I mean? Like
like those, following the trends and
exactly
whatnot.
In the realm of photography, you see it all over Instagram. Like everyone's Instagram like looks the same. Like, you know, everyone's portfolio, like that they're using these like filters you can download off the internet or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, it's so crazy too. Cause like, I often like look at these photographers or these people and I'm like, how are they getting work?
Mm-hmm.
And it's literally, especially where I live, it's very homogenous, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just being afraid to like, it's being afraid to invest in good art, and it's being like people are afraid to like here at least to invest in something that is true to them and unique.
Hmm.
And that's scary for some people, you know, like
absolutely. Especially when maybe your income is dependent upon your work.
Oh, like exactly.
That's a terrifying place to be.
Yeah. And there, I mean, I know people like painters and photographers who, you know, are really talented, but they've succumbed to trends and they've succumbed to, you know, creating work that looks like the next, you know?
Yeah.
And it's so frustrating. It like kills me inside. Cause it's like, dude, or, you know, you have this amazing voice and you're like wasting it. And I never want to do that. I don't ever want to do that. Like I never.
Well, hold on a second, because that's I want to hear more about that, because you don't want that. What do you want? Like in the context of your work, Rich.
Yeah.
Like what is it that you want? And like, do you have like a dream project? Do you have like an ultimate ambition in the context of your work that all of your decisions and choices are leading toward?
Yeah, I don't know, man. That's a tough question.
Rich, I'm just going to cut you off. I'm sorry. I've heard a therapist tell me, they say, and I think this is echoed in the movie Good Will Hunting. So maybe therapists haven't said it. Maybe just Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting.
It was probably Robin Williams.
Yeah, it probably was. But he, in that movie where he's asking Will, what do you want? And Will can't answer. And he's like, you can answer for me all this other stuff. But I think there's something for me, there's something really, really significant in that exchange in that movie between Robin Williams and Matt Damon. That's like, I think I'm amazed at how I can sometimes dance around all these other questions and thoughts. But if I sit there and go,
what do I want?
Like, what do I want? And not just in the context of creativity or art, But like what kind of husband do I want to be? Like, what kind of brother do I want to be to my older and younger sister? Like, what kind of friend do I want to be? Like, just what do I want? Like, sometimes that question and answer for me is so elusive, and I really have no answer.
Yeah, nor do I. I don't know. I don't know. Like, it's one of those things, like all of those things you talked about, like about being like a husband or a friend, or like what kind of husband or friend I want to be, or what kind of an artist do I want to be? Like, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't, and maybe that's my fault. Like, maybe that's where I need to grow as an artist or as a person, is think about those things more. But honestly, right now it's just like, I have all this shit in my head and I'm just trying to get it out. You know what I mean? At this point, like, you know, I'm still very new to art. I've only been, you know, doing photography for 7 years, you know, and professionally like the past two. So it's like, it's hard. Like, I'm still working on finding my own voice, and like, I'm still working on, you know, becoming an individual.
Do you feel like that's ever a process that's completed? Because people, I am asked that question frequently, like, when did you find your voice? And I feel like the answer that I want to give is, well, it happened at this moment. But I feel like the honest answer is, I feel like I'm always finding it. I feel like I'm always familiarizing myself with yourself. My voice in work. I mean, it's like the Austin Powers, allow myself to introduce myself. Yeah,
exactly.
But it's like, but I feel like that's kind of this, this infinite process, at least for me, that's been my experience thus far, that doesn't really reach like this kind of finish line, that it's always a greater sense of familiarization.
You know what's crazy is, like, I try to get that in other people before I do in myself. Like, when I take portraits, I try like my best to get, like, they, some of the agencies out here will send me models to photograph and do test shoots with and whatever. So that I can, like, you know, market them and get them material so that other agencies, like in New York or London or whatever, can like see them and go, oh, this person has potential to be here. And it's just like, you know, like when those people come and sit down and sit in for me in a portrait session, the immediately, like, the first thing they do is like they pose, or they assume this person that isn't them. And like, this person that I can just, it's just obvious. You can tell it isn't them, you know, maybe I'm just like, that's my way of like trying to do it myself, is to like get other people to do it so I can see it and go, it's not that bad.
Yeah,
like,
right.
You can be yourself. Like, you can find out who you are.
Yeah. Right.
If I can get someone to do it in an hour, you know, and it's just like, or 2 hours, it's crazy.
But that leads me to think, like, cause that's a challenging job that you have. That's very different than, say, like the typical artistic arena that I am in, where I show up and, I mean, you know, it's the proverbial me and the blank page. But in your work, especially when you're dealing with, you know, like a model or a human subject, you have to create an environment in which they can be creative. Like, how do you create an environment in which someone else can effectively and freely collaborate with you?
Yeah, you know what? The first thing is, like, letting them know it's a safe place. Like, people need, like, safe places. People need a spot where they can come and just chill and, like, drop everything, you know? And, yeah, so, like, before we even start taking portraits or start working together, like, I love opening conversations and dialogue, and so, like, seeing what's going on in their lives. And, like, you can tell how – you can often tell, like, how deep someone wants to go. But – for the most part, people like open up about some pretty, you know, deep stuff and like stuff that they're going through in the moment or whatever. And it's just like, I like to visit those things in a portrait session and like have someone think about, you know, the memory that we were just talking about before we started shooting, or, you know, like, you know, to basically bring themselves into like a real person, like a real, like with all their emotions, all their shit, you know, like just reality, you know.
We had on the show recently Mina, and it's so embarrassing, I butchered her name like 7 times, and so I'm not even gonna say her last name. She's this remarkable international model, and it was so fun and for me really enlightening to hear her talk about her process when she's in front of the camera. And I think I did, hearing her talk about it, and even upon further reflection, I admire her ability to rally all these different components of who she is before a camera. And I am one of the most unphotogenic people in the history of
weird.
Mankind. But part of the reason is I really struggle to be vulnerable in front of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And writing for me is a way of creating just enough barrier that I can be, I don't know, I guess that I can be a little bit more naked. You know, it's like in the moment, it's just me and a laptop. And later on, it's in the minds of other people.
Yeah.
But I oftentimes, I don't even interact with those people.
Hmm.
But so like, I think I admire that in her, and I admire your ability to draw that out of another person and create, I don't know, an environment in which people feel that that is not only safe, but that it's the best thing.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's like, those are two different things. I mean, it's one thing if you tell people, hey, it's permissible for you to be vulnerable. It's another thing when you communicate to somebody, again, whether it's in an artistic collaboration or in an interpersonal relationship, when you communicate, the most magical thing you can be is whatever you currently are
exactly.
right now. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. And it, but that's the thing. I was like, when I was figuring out, like, you know, what photographers I liked, or whose work I liked and adored, and like who I wanted to like label as influences, like people like Helmut Newton came to mind, or like Bruce Weber, or, you know, like current people like Jamie Hawksworth. Like, these are photographers that like are really good at capturing reality. Like, they're people that are really good at capturing, like, you know, real life. Mm. And it's so crazy. Like, my friend Cole, one of my best friends, Cole, he assisted Bruce Weber once, and his job was to like carry around the boombox. So they like...
Wait, what was playing on the boombox?
I have no idea.
Like, I'm picturing Run DMC or something like that.
I think I remember him saying that, like, Bruce said, like, play something beachy. Cause they were on a beach.
Okay.
And he started playing reggae, and Bruce was like, no, not like that. And it's just like, what? That's the most beachy thing you can play. Like, but yeah. And it's just like, that was Bruce's way, like using music as a way to like lower walls and lower barriers. You know what I mean?
Do you have a particular work, Rich, that you're most proud of?
I would say, okay. So like, I would say that, I have this series of shots. It's three different photographs, and the work is called, it's entitled Existential Loneliness Action 2. It followed like this first action where I take a woman and we went out into like the petrified national forest. This is about the first act.
Where is that? Where's the petrified national?
Oh, it's like 3.5 hours. Yeah, it's in Arizona. It's like 3.5 hours northeast of Phoenix.
Okay.
And it's you know, nicknamed the Painted Desert, and the hills are like crazy. It basically used to, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago, it used to be a forest.
Wow.
And all the trees have turned, you know, all their organic materials been replaced by minerals, and it all has crumbled, and now it's, you know, it's just this wild and waste land.
Hmm.
And like, I basically took this person who, and I wanted to portray like uncomfortableness, like isolation, like how uncomfortable it is to be alone and to feel alone.
Hmm.
You know, and then I wanted to end with the embrace of loneliness, like where in the end it's realized that it's a gift to be alone, to like to experience things in your own way, to, you know, have your own experience. So the second action I created, I think, is my most favorite and most intimate pieces of artwork. I met this like friend at my work, and he was married to this girl for like 10 years. Mm-hmm. And he always knew this about himself, but like it was after a lot of like getting to know himself.
Mm-hmm.
He just, you know, he realized that what he needed from the marriage, he wasn't getting, cause he was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scary, like being raised in, you know, a really conservative home. And then coming to realizations like that, like something about yourself that's always been there, but it's always been pushed away. You know, you're 10 years into this relationship. Like you can't just like leave, especially, you know, and it's just like all this pressure on himself to maintain this old identity. And he decided at the end that it wasn't worth it. Like he wanted to just be himself, you know, he wanted to embrace who he was and he wanted honesty in that relationship and also in future relationships. And so, you know, through getting to know him and like realizing his story, it compelled me. I was like, and see, like, this is where the weird thing happens, like where people may think you're weird, but I was like, can I, like, I'm fascinated by your story.
Yeah.
I want to bury you in the ground. Yeah. He's just like, what? So basically what the whole premise was like, I grew up in a very like Christian environment. And though I wouldn't consider myself a current believer, there are things that still I find beautiful about that faith. Baptism is one of them. And it's basically like the ritual of being put to death and then raised again, right? And I was like, man, like how cool would it be if I literally buried someone and had them raise themselves out of their own grave?
And the fact that you're doing this in a petrified forest.
Yeah. Well, wow. This one was not in a petrified forest. This one was even more random. This one we drove on the I-10 towards LA and we like pulled off on this random riverbank, and I was like, this is the spot, we're gonna do it. So like we hiked for, you know, like 30-40 minutes, and we're talking about this, and I just remember I was digging this grave. I just was like getting really emotional, like I was like, wow, like, you know, I'm preparing this ritual for someone that has gone through this, you know, event in their life, or this has this story. And I remember like as he like climbed in the hole and I was like putting dirt over his back, I just saw his back, like, you know, like you could visibly see he was crying and like he was upset. And I was just like, this is why I do what I do. Like, this is the exact reason why I can't help but create, is because this person is now dealing with their trauma. You know what I mean? And I just remember that, like, when he, like, you know, when I was burying him, how I started weeping and I started crying. It was like, we were both like connected in that moment, like feeling each other's like grief, you know? And it was so rad too. Cause I was like, all right, now like raise out of the, like get like after a while, like after, like I walked away and like let him have his moments, you know, in there underneath the earth. And then finally I was like, all right, now like get up and like, you know, rise, like get like rise up out of the dirt. He did it so slowly. It was almost as if he wanted to stay there. You know what I mean? Like it was almost as if he wanted to stay under the earth. It was reluctantly. But then as he started getting taller and taller, you could see pride and you can see like this like overwhelming sense of like beauty and like almost like he's seeing the world in a new way. You know what I mean? Yeah, that was nuts. And here's the reason why that's like, I mean, here's another reason why that's one of my favorite pieces, is I showed that at a gallery here in downtown Phoenix. And believe it or not, like Phoenix is a really awesome, like the queer community here is awesome. Like it's such a vibrant like community here. And it was crazy because like at my show, like there were a lot of people who identified as like gay, lesbian, trans, like that came to the show. And I remember at the end, like right when, you know, the wine had run out and, you know, everyone was kind of walking away, this young man, he was about, you know, 17 or 18, pulled me outside. He's like, can I talk to you? And like, he was like shaking. And I was like, yeah. I was like, why is he like, you know?
Yeah.
And, I pulled him outside and he was like, I just want to let you know that like your work has like inspired me to be who I am. Like he was telling me about how his father like condemned him because he was gay. He had just come out to his father, and instead of his father like accepting him or like bringing him in, like his father was like, you know,
disowned. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. And it was just like this, he's like, seeing this like has empowered me to know that I'm not weird, that I'm normal and that it's not wrong. You know, I was just like, damn, like this is home. You know, like this is like this is what it's about.
Hmm.
You know, because like for me with that, it was like while I was burying him, it was like for me, it was religion, like leaving religion, something that I identified with for so long. And then slowly standing up and like trying to feel some sort of, you know, autonomy and pride and like being an individual and thinking for myself, you know, kind of a thing. So yeah, it was emotional for everyone.
Where is there a place where listeners could see that work? Is that like,
yeah, it's on my website. Like
what's your website?
It's richarddouglas.co.
richarddouglas.co.
Yeah.
And really like, I'm trying to picture in my head those pieces in particular, but the other pieces of yours that I've seen, I mean, they carry a certain emotional current. I mean, even if it's subtle, like there is a real heartbeat to all of it, you know? And so, I mean, really, yeah. You should check it out. And Rich, you know, one of the things that I think empowers your work and allows your work to have that heartbeat is there's such precision in it. Hmm. There's such detail in it. Like I've heard people say that ambiguity has no heartbeat, you know, that ambiguity kind of drowns out like the precise emotion or sentiment or experience that either a human or whatever is going through. And your work carries such a precision. I mean, you did the cover of the magazine here in Phoenix, Zephyr. And I think I told you when I saw that photograph that it was like agony under this elegant face. and I loved it. Yeah. I thought it was remarkable, but I think I admire that about you. And I think that's so important and essential to any creative endeavor is to seek detail. You know, to seek precision, because it does seem that oftentimes when a work is nebulous, that we lose kind of the pulse of it in the process.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard though, because like I'm also fond of ambiguity. Like I also like there are some pieces that I have where people are like, "What the hell does that even mean?" And like I'll tell them.
Yeah,
but like
right.
You know, but there's also a piece of it too where people. Where you want to also allow people to take what they want from your piece.
Yes.
Like where you don't want to limit experience.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But ambiguity of meaning is different than ambiguity of image.
Ah, yes.
So when you like I'm, you know, here in, you know, Rich's dining room, like I'm looking at one of his pieces of work now, and it's a landscape, and there's all this dry brush, but like I'm seeing individual blades of grass, like I'm seeing kind of the desiccation of earth.
You're seeing a scene.
Yeah,
there's a scene being set up.
Yes, and I'm seeing it in such like stark clarity, but you're not telling me what to feel about it. And I to your point, I think that's so essential to artists, to give people the liberty and the space to see what they see. I mean, to allow our work to be like Rorschach's, right? So it's like people seeing it what they see, and to give people space for that. But a lot of times I do think it's the detail that empowers people to focus in on something and find themselves for their own experience in it. And your work, I mean, it's one of the many reasons why I'm such a fan of your work.
Hey, thanks, man.
Thanks for letting me sit at your dining room table here in Phoenix for being on The Marrow. Thanks so much, Rich. Thanks so much for listening to The Marrow. To find me on social media for upcoming live appearances or to buy a book, you can visit joshreebach.com. Please join me again next week.